Case taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the now labeled fifth case, the United States versus Robertson. Ms. Murphy.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. My name is Erin Murphy, and I represent Henry and Elizabeth Robertson. Elizabeth is in the Court with us today. The Robertsons participated in a mortgage fraud scheme in the late 1990s. The government did not bring charges against the Robertsons for 10 years after they participated in this scheme. As a result of that delay and of this court's decision in United States versus Damari, the Robertsons were sentenced under significantly higher guidelines ranges than applied at the time of their offense. This court should overrule its erroneous decision in Damari and join its sister circuits in holding that retroactive application of harsher guidelines ranges is an ex post facto clause violation that entitles the Robertsons to a remand for resentencing. The Robertsons are also entitled to resentencing because the district court erred by applying a two-level aggravating role enhancement that was not supported by the record or the district court's findings, and because the district court failed to take into consideration the Robertsons' compelling arguments for below-guideline sentences, particularly their arguments relating to their 10 years of self-motivated rehabilitation. If I may, I would like to discuss the ex post facto clause issue before turning to the other two issues in the case. Since this court last revisited any of the issues that were decided in Damari, five additional courts of appeals have rejected Damari and every aspect of its analysis. I think it's also now clear that Damari is inconsistent with this court's own case law in the plain error context. In plain error cases, this court has routinely recognized that when a district court errs by applying higher guidelines range than it should, that is a plain error that affects a defendant's substantial rights. The reasoning of those cases is that applying higher guidelines produces higher sentences, absent some indication in the record that the district court didn't rely on the guidelines. That's precisely what proves an ex post facto clause violation. The question in the ex post facto clause context is whether there is a significant risk of higher sentences because higher guidelines are used. So I don't think that Damari can be reconciled with this court's own case law. I think the only way that you could try to reconcile it is by relying on Damari's distinction between laws that bind and laws that advise. But to the extent that Damari intended that to be a categorical distinction, Damari is flatly inconsistent with Supreme Court precedent because Garner versus Jones squarely rejects that distinction as a facial matter. In Garner, the court said, yes, we recognize that this is an advisory regulation, a probation board regulation, that the probation board does not have to follow. But the court nonetheless went on to consider the practical implementation of that regulation.
Ms. Murphy, does that turn this into an empirical question?
I think to some extent.
I mean, statistical studies?
Looking at Garner, yes. Garner very clearly invokes.
Does that make any sense?
Well,
and what happens to the person, the first one who's sentenced after the change, who can't show the statistical imbalance?
Well, I think that, you know, perhaps when you're talking about the person in the first instance, there might have to be a presumption that until we know that, you know, you look at the way that that something like the guidelines operates. And here, there are a lot of legal reasons to assume in the first instance that the guidelines are likely to continue to produce higher sentences.
Right. But if we look at, I mean, Miller against Florida is probably the closest case to this one where we've got a guidelines system. But the court's opinion seemed to emphasize that those were binding guidelines.
It did, but I think the court backed away from that, particularly in Garner. And in Garner, the court did specifically emphasize that in Morales, its earlier decision dealing with probation, it was laws, not regulations there, but dealing with changes to probation that were advisory, The court had emphasized statistics. The court had pointed out in Morales that there was evidence that 85 to 90% of parole of people seeking parole don't get parole. So it was pretty clear that it didn't matter. In Garner, the court said, we need to remand here and give the inmate a chance to actually seek additional discovery on whether there is information that could be developed that would demonstrate that even though this is a regulation set down by the parole board itself within its own discretion to create regulations, it's a regulation that has that operates at a practical level to produce a significant risk of longer sentences.
Can I ask you about one of your alternative argument there?
Sure.
Was, well, even if we stick to Demery, as mistaken as you think it is, that we ought to abandon the presumption of reasonableness.
Mm-hmm.
As I was reading that, frankly, I was wondering, well, shouldn't we just broaden the presumption of reasonableness to apply it to any sentence under old or new guidelines on the assumption that the Sentencing Commission is always reasonable, even when it changes its mind?
Well, I think if the court did that, it would kind of exacerbate the problem with Demery, because I think the best reading of Demery is that Demery looked at the way sentencing operates and said, you know, courts, they're not really paying as much attention to the guidelines now as they were before when they were mandatory. So if the court broadens the presumption, I mean, you know, by this court's analysis in Demery, the presumption shouldn't matter really at all, because the court is saying, you know, that it's disagreeing with the D.C. Circuit's opinion in Turner, which said that courts are likely to give guideline sentences because of the presumption. So if that's correct, then broadening the presumption just really makes this problem worse. Whereas I think if you get rid of the presumption, you know, maybe the court's right in Demery. If you get rid of the presumption, then it doesn't really matter one way or another. But if the court is wrong in Demery, getting rid of the presumption is a way that helps to make sure that Demery's view of the sentencing guidelines is an accurate one, because it helps ensure that even if this court may think that the presumption doesn't encourage district courts to give guideline sentences, you know, getting rid of it might produce a real difference in cases like this one. I think it would also help with the fact that Demery is creating a very real sentencing disparity, because whichever side of the split is right, the practical matter here is that the similarly situated defendants are going to be sentenced under higher and different guidelines in this circuit than in at least six other circuits. So, you know, obviously that militates toward the need for this to be a circuit split that needs to be resolved, but it also suggests this court could do something discretionary, like get rid of the presumption of reasonableness, to try and help with the problem. We do have two other arguments as to why we think that resentencing is appropriate here. The first is the erroneous aggravating role enhancement. I think we have a real problem here with the government having conceded below that its evidence just wasn't sufficient to demonstrate exactly what role the Robertsons had in relation to the other participants in this scheme. And this is a scheme that involved all sorts of real estate professionals, sophisticated individuals, whose participation was clearly necessary to make this scheme operate. The district court said on the record that the evidence did not clearly define the Robertsons' role in this scheme. What we know is what they admitted in their plea agreement, which is that they recruited nominee purchasers and gave them funding. And sometimes they gave them some advice as to how to conceal the source of that. That's almost identical to the evidence that the D.C. Circuit found insufficient to support any kind of aggravating role enhancement in Quigley. So I think that the reasoning the D.C. Circuit applied there is correct. We need some sort of evidence of a hierarchical relationship that demonstrates that the Robertsons were actually more at fault for what was going on than any of the other participants in this scheme. And largely because of the government's 10-year delay in bringing this case, we don't have that evidence. The government couldn't bring forward other people and demonstrate that the Robertsons were the ones who roped all of these sophisticated real estate individuals into the scheme. We don't have even any kind of documentation for a lot of this stuff. So we have a lot of problems here, and it was the government's burden to provide this evidence. The government did not, so the enhancement was erroneous. And our final thing I will just mention briefly before saving some time for rebuttal is that the district court really didn't give any consideration to the Robertsons' 10 years of rehabilitation here. The court was talking earlier about Pepper. In Pepper, the Supreme Court described post-offense self-motivated rehabilitation as the most accurate indicator of a defendant's characteristics and tendencies for purposes of determining an appropriate sentence. And here we have no indication on this record that the district court gave any consideration to that argument before it imposed these perfunctory within-guideline sentences.
Ms. Murphy, could I just ask you on that? In addition to Pepper, if you look at our sentencing cases, which do you think are the strongest ones in terms of support for concluding that what was said on the record about these mitigation arguments just wasn't enough?
I think the strongest case is Miranda that we cite in our brief. In Miranda, there was all sorts of evidence of diminished capacity, and the district court in that case acknowledged on the record that a bunch of evidence had come in about diminished capacity, but the district court didn't explain whether he found that evidence worth consideration and didn't explain whether he had rejected it or considered it before imposing a within-guideline sentence. So I think that that decision very clearly supports that even if a district, reading the record here, obviously these arguments were made. I'm not saying the district court flatly ignored them, but what this court instructed in Miranda is it takes something more when you're presented with a recognized basis for a below-guideline sentence, which is exactly what was presented in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Murphy. Mr. Farrar?
May it please the Court. On behalf of the United States, my name is Michael Ferrara. Defendant sentences should stand. The sentences were reasonable and properly determined based on the 3553A factors without procedural error. In the court below, defendants waived any right to bring a ex post facto argument before this court. The defendants agreed in each of their plea agreements that the current version, the version at the time of sentencing, of the guidelines manual would apply. In addition to that, in the PSR...
That was consistent with our binding precedent, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And the defendants were further made aware of this court's binding precedent in the pre-sentence investigation reports. The pre-sentence investigation reports expressly cite to this court's decision in Damari in announcing to the defendants and the district court that the proper guidelines manual to be used at sentencing was in fact the 2010 manual.
Right. So wouldn't it have been kind of a waste of time to try to convince the district court otherwise?
And Your Honor, that's exactly the government's argument. The defendants were both aware of the content of the PSR. They objected to other portions of the PSR, and they did not bring any objection to the district court that would, in a sense, have been frivolous at the district court level.
Right.
The district court was
bound. So why is that a waiver?
Mm-hmm. Correct, Your Honor. The district court was bound by this court's decision in Damari. Both defendants were represented by able defense counsel, experienced defense counsel that had practiced for quite some time in the district court, and they decided in their sound judgment to bring other arguments that they found to be more persuasive. The district court did not agree. The defense counsel presented the arguments in terms of the 3553A factors as they should, including the delay in this case being brought to justice. Both defense counsel submitted and the government agreed that the court could, in fact, properly consider as mitigation the fact that the offense was over 10 years old and that both defendants had demonstrated to the court the ability to stay out of trouble in that intervening time. However, the court did not find that argument persuasive, and expressly with respect to defendant Henry Robertson, the court used those words, that the court was not persuaded by that argument. The court, to be clear, the court made that argument, or I'm sorry, issued that statement in connection to a review of the defendant's criminal history. In the court below, the argument was centered around the fact that defendant's criminal history with respect to Henry Robertson overstated the seriousness of his criminal history. The court was very succinct in its analysis of that point, but it's clear from a reading of the record as a whole that the court understood that the argument that was being presented to it was that defendant Henry Robertson in particular had time to demonstrate to the court that he had been rehabilitated in the sense that he had avoided trouble for a long time. The court did not find that persuasive.
This is a pretty unusual case, Mr. Farrar, with the 10-year delay and the I know there was a reckless driving thing in there in 2002, but apart from that, you've got clean records. Sent the kids to college, worked, and so on. What's the best indication from the record that the district court really seriously considered that argument?
Your Honor, if I may break the answer into two parts. With respect to Elizabeth Robertson, it's very clear. Elizabeth Robertson had no prior criminal history, so in a sense, there's no distinction between prior criminal conduct and rehabilitation, in that both before and after the offense.
Can you direct me to the district judge's statements that show that he really gave serious consideration to these points?
Again, Your Honor, albeit succinct, the court stated verbatim, "The court has considered your history, which fortunately reflects the commission of no offenses. The court has also considered what has to be described as a very traumatic childhood, as well as the excellent service you've provided as a professional in the medical field." So with respect to Mrs. Robertson, it's clear from, albeit that succinct statement, that the court was aware of the argument that was made before it, and again was not persuaded by that, and instead fell back to what the court found to be the serious nature of this offense, which, as the court indicated, was a fraud that extended for the course of 31 months, that involved 37 separate fraudulent transactions, resulting in $5 million worth of loans and a loss in excess of $700,000. With respect to Henry Robertson, again, it's admittedly succinct, but the court stated that the court is not persuaded by your argument that the criminal history calculation overrepresents the seriousness of your criminal background. Although you have not committed any crime since 2002, the court notes that you committed the 2002 reckless driving offense when you were 48 years old and not youthful or immature. What can be extrapolated from the court's succinct statement in that regard is that the court was in fact aware of the totality of defendant Henry Robertson's criminal history, his nature and circumstances, as he stood before the court at the time of sentencing. The court, again, was not persuaded by the fact that the defendant Henry Robertson had managed to avoid trouble in the intervening 10 years, and instead, once again, pointing back to the 3553A factors, the court was in fact persuaded by the nature of the offense, which the court statement there is verbatim to Mrs. Robertson's, in that the offense spanned 31 months, involved 37 properties.
Right. Given the relevance and weight that this sort of evidence had, though, in Pepper against the United States, this is pretty unusual, isn't it?
Your Honor, I mean, as this court has held on multiple occasions, for example, in United States versus Scott, this court said that it is perfectly okay for a court to be succinct when imposing a guideline sentence, that a lengthy recitation is not necessary, as well as in United States versus Shannon. This court explained that it's not necessary for the district court to effectively go through a checklist and go through all of the 3553A factors. Instead, what is important is that the record indicates that the district court understood its discretion, understood what it was required to consider under 3553A, and fashioned a reasonable sentence accordingly. Here, that is, in fact, clear. Although the court didn't go through in detail each of the 3553A factors, with respect to each defendant, the court outlined those factors and said that it was guided by those factors. So it listed each of the factors that appears in 18 U.S.C. 3553A, but instead of going through each as a checklist that this court has indicated is not required, that the court focused on what it found to be persuasive. And again, in this particular instance, the court was persuaded by the nature of this offense, which was a serious offense, which, in fact, but for the 10-year delay in bringing the case to justice, where evidence was degraded and things along those lines, in the ordinary course, a multi-million-dollar mortgage fraud resulting in hundreds of thousands of dollars of loss that spanned several years, that spanned double-digit victims, very easily could have resulted in a high-end guideline sentence, if not higher. So it's, again, looking at the totality of the record, although it is short, it is clear that the district court understood the arguments that were made to it in mitigation. In viewing those arguments in mitigation, the court decided that the reasonable sentence, the appropriate sentence, was at the low end of the guideline range, where if the court had simply ignored the arguments in mitigation and looked purely at the offense, the court very easily could have gone to the high end of the guidelines or above, given what occurred in this particular instance.
With respect to the ex post facto argument, does it make a difference that at the time these crimes were committed, the guidelines were binding?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. What matters in this particular case is what the state
of... Well, let's go back to the state of affairs in 1999, okay? The guidelines are binding, and the kind of issue that you all are raising would look an awful lot like Miller against Florida, right? With binding guidelines where an increase creates an ex post facto problem.
I certainly don't disagree with Your Honor, but again, I believe that the more important principle here is the law that was in effect at the time of sentencing. That
well, but if the assumption is criminals are going to be rational actors who are entitled to know what punishment they're facing, nobody in 1999, very few people in the legal profession would have predicted in 1999 that the guidelines would become only advisory 10 years later. Right?
Your Honor, that could very well be correct if this offense was sentenced in 1999. The fact that it wasn't, the fact that it was sentenced in 2010 and in 2010 law applied, there was an appropriate mechanism in place for the court to balance the current version of the guidelines versus the guidelines at the time of the offense, so that the court can consider as a 3553A factor the guidelines that were in place in 1998 or 1999 versus the guidelines that were in place in 2010. That was not an argument that was raised in mitigation below, but nonetheless it would be perfectly appropriate for the court or any district court to consider the disparity in those guidelines in fashioning a sentence that's consistent with Booker and consistent with the sentencing goals of 3553A. Nonetheless, Your Honor, with respect to that ex post facto argument, once again, the defendants had, in fact, waived in the district court below. If not waiver, there was forfeiture. But nonetheless, the defendants' sentences were, in fact, reasonable for the reason that I just discussed. And Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. If I may briefly conclude. Sentences were fashioned without procedural error in accordance with the 3553A factors. The district court recognized its discretion and sentenced accordingly. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Frere. Ms. Murphy?
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to just make two quick points. One, I think it's absolutely not correct that they waived this argument below. Waiver is applied liberally in favor of the defendant. All we have here is a standard plea agreement that said this is what we think the guidelines are, but everybody's free to dispute them up until the time of sentencing. They did not raise the argument, but as Your Honor has pointed out, it would have been pretty much futile to raise it. The district court had no discretion to do anything other than follow Damari. So there's really nothing to be gained here from the fact that, I guess, in a technical sense, this is a plain error case. And the other thing I'd like to mention briefly is the attempt to portray the district court as having taken these arguments seriously in terms of their arguments in mitigation. The court has very clearly said when arguments are presented that provide a recognized basis for imposing a below-guideline sentence, the district court has to give its reasons for rejecting those arguments. It's not enough that the district court gives the reasons for the sentence that it did give. It has to give its reasons for not giving a below-guideline sentence when a defendant gives arguments that would support one. That's what the district court failed to do here. For all of the reasons that are in our briefs, we think that a remand for resentencing is warranted. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.